So, I have to begin with a little apology and a little propaganda. The apology is that at first you may not see why I'm speaking in this conference about non-commutative geometry. But that's for the apology, and I will explain by making some propaganda. Well, you all know the name of Feynman and the deep method, or the deep ideas of Feynman to quantize mechanics. And by the way, I have a book which is published by Cambridge University Press these days, long collaboration with Cecil DeWitt, and where we try to explain how is it now with the Feynman path integral. So just in a nutshell, Feynman path integrals are a really fantastic way to go from the non-commutative world to the commutative world to the non-commutative world. It's one way to look at it. But basically what you have, I mean, if you consider matrix calculus, of course, the prototype of non-commutative multiplication is multiplying matrices. But if I write, so this L, M, and P, of course, is non-commutative. But if I write the indices, alpha, omega is alpha, beta, beta, gamma, gamma, omega. Well, and of course, sum over intermediate value, beta and gamma. So that's just a standard way to calculate the product of matrices. But you see, of course, you have here commutative operation. You multiply number, you sum of them. Where is the non-commutativity? Is in the fact that you are summing, beta is followed by beta, gamma is followed by gamma. That means there is a certain ordering into the indices that you make summation of. Now, more sophisticated, if you have a quantum mechanical system, let's see, with a finite degree of freedom, number of freedom, then you have ordinary trajectories Q of T, in the classical mechanics, Lagrangian mechanics, which is a vector with certain set of coordinates, Q alpha of T, which represents the evolution of your system during when the time evolves. And of course, you know that the real trajectory is a solution of the Euler-Lagrange equation. And this Euler-Lagrange equation can be summed up by saying that the variation of S, the action, is zero. S is the action, which is a certain functional. S is a certain functional of the path. I represent by Q the function Q of T. Okay, so you have a certain functional of the path. This is defined not only for the real path, the path which has followed in the evolution of the system, but for all possible paths. And then you select the one, Q classical, which annihilates the first variation of the action, certain nonlinear functional. That's classical mechanics. On the other hand, in quantum mechanics, according to Feynman, you do the following. Well, of course, you have to put boundary conditions. So I have to put that Q at an initial time TA is a certain position QA, and at finite time TB, it's XB. So it's the variation is made over all paths with fixed ends. Similarly, in quantum mechanics, according to Feynman, what you have, you consider the collection of all such paths now with the same initial and finite condition. Now, you consider for all such paths, and you denote by PAB, P for paths, the set A is a system, well, F is a system XATA, that means a point in space-time, and B is XBTB, a point in space-time. So you have in the space-time paths going from A to B, and you have, so Q, you take exponential of I, S of Q, divided by h bar, and you integrate whatever is the meaning of the integration, you integrate over all possible paths. Okay, and since h is small compared to the dimension of actual system, macroscopic system, well, except that quantum physics exists in the macroscopic world. I mean, a laser beam or similar objects, I mean, are quantum objects in our world. But nevertheless, when S of Q is significantly larger than 8, it's a highly oscillating integral. And according to well-known principle in oscillating integrals, The main contribution comes from the fifth, which is explained the transition in a short way, the transition between the quantum world and the classical world. And now what is this expression? It depends on A and B, so you write it as XBTB, XATA, and what you have is that this is defined to kernel, or if you want, when TA and TB are fixed, are given, it's a kernel for an integral operator going from the function of XA to the function of XB, and the evolution, the time evolution, that means the unitary operator which brings TA to TB doesn't have to be time, you don't need time invariance, you TATB is an operator, unitary operator, whose kernel is given by this. So it's a way of again, the manipulation of this unitary operator in the Hilbert space is belongs to the non-commutative world. Nevertheless, you have been able to express this by an integration. And of course, if you think about it, it's very reminiscent to that. I don't have to indulge on that. But the point is that the knowledge, it's a certain way of quantization, which if you know the action for the classical path, then enables you, at least formally, to write the evolution operator. And, of course, for ordinary quantum mechanics, it doesn't tell you much more than what is known by ordinary method, but it's very important when you go from quantum mechanics to quantum field theory. And quantum field theory is much more complicated, but then what you have, of course, according to Feynman's insight, is, first of all, in quantum field theory, you try to express evolution operator or more general object of this kind, scattering matrices and so on, in terms of functional integration. Now, S of Q will be replaced by a classical field. But, of course, you have to do the calculation, and the calculations are mostly done using Feynman diagrams. So that brings me to the graphical calculus. So my principle will be the following. I take, if I have a field phi, S of phi is usually written as the integral over some domain, MD, which is, let's say, usually Minkowski space, for instance, D equal 4, of a certain functional L f phi of x d dx. L of phi of x is a certain expression which depends on the point x and the function phi, and that gives you S of phi. And now this is L of phi of x is a Lagrangian, and what I want to explain today is a strategy of nonlinear transformation in Lagrangian. It's one way of looking at renormalization, which is there. It's not surprising. It's just slightly at a variance from the ordinary position. And the point which I have in mind is that using this strategy, first of all, I can understand the graphical calculus. Well, that means some way of looking at the Feynman diagrams. And on the other end, so I will be able to produce a group, and this group will amount to be the same, to be the same that correspond to the Kronenkheimer Hopf algebra or to the corresponding Lie algebra. Okay, so that's my aim today. So I want to mention this. So this is the introduction. I spoke already about it. So Kronenkheimer have introduced a certain Hopf algebra. With my student Berg, we emphasize the corresponding Lie algebra. And both correspond to a certain group, and my aim is to describe directly this group, and then to derive from the group the Lie algebra and the Hopf algebra, just inverting the standard way. As applications, I will not have time to speak in detail about the application, but a symmetry coefficient. There were some nasty question about symmetry coefficient diagram, and I had a long argument with Dirk about that, and now I think it's solved. There was a question of normalizing things and taking into account the number of automorphisms of your graph. You have to be careful, and now I think with my new method I settled this question, or rather my student did it. That's partly taken from his master thesis, and his master thesis will be put on the website of IHS as soon as I can revise it. So, and on the other hand, there was a theorem by Kuhn and Kramer about nonlinear transformation of coupling constant, and I will give you a strategy to derive this without almost any calculation. So that's my aim. So, and you've seen, and now I begin, and just to show you, well, I will keep on the other side the plan of this lecture. So you will see, I will be, well, we begin by some words about operat, then Lagrangian, then regularization. I was uncertain whether to put a Z or an S at regularization. It depends where I give a talk. And then the toy model and its graphics, and then some hint about some applications. Okay, so what is the first part? The first part is about operat. Well, operat is now a very fashionable subject in algebra and topology. I will be just give you a simple-minded approach to operat. Operat is a theory of operations, as it suggested. So, I take an operation, which is I call f of x1 up to xn. So it depends on an input, which has n different values, x1 up to xn. And it gives an output, which is f of x1, xn. Now, the basic operation is substitution. Oh, sorry. The basic construction is substitution. And substitution, there are various ways, but the simplest way is the following. You take a function f, which depends on n variable. You select an index I between 1 and n, and in f of x1 up to xn, you substitute to xi a function g of other variables. And then you reorder the variable in a proper way, just a matter of describing the indices. So here is the explicit construction, h of x1 to xn plus p minus 1. So you had n variables in f, p variables in g, altogether the n plus p is a contraction, so it's n plus p minus 1. Now, it's better explained by a graphical representation, which is exactly what one calls a flow chart in computers, and a flow chart, so a flow chart, I represent the operation, just taking n equals 3 for instantiation, so f of x1, x2, x3, y received according to standard notation in computers, and y is allocated the value of x1, x2, x3, and is represented by your flow chart. So the input is at the bottom, x1, x2, x3, then it's processed by some operation or some program f, and the output is y. Now, of course, the substitution graphically is very easy to understand. I mean, you take the what corresponds to f. Now, below f as n prongs, and you select one, let's say here the second one, and then you sew or glue to the second prong of f, what corresponds to g. And of course, the orientation is from bottom to top. Let's stand down in flowchart, bottom to top. I don't write explicitly the orientation because they are implicitly from bottom to top. And so you see that at the place where at the top of g, which is here, at the top of g, you insert it into one of the legs of f. Okay, so that just describes the composition, and it's very convenient, but it's as you will see, it's slightly more special than the things we need in Feynman diagram. The Feynman diagram will be a little more complicated than that, but just to give an example. So, okay, now what you have is that suppose that you have one binary operation. One binary operation is represented by this fork oriented from bottom to top, and so it represents you have two inputs and one output, multiplication. And associativity is represented graphically by this simple rule that if you have a tree, two trees, they are equivalent. So you can shift one of the legs of the tree from the left. The intermediate leg in the tree can be shifted from the left to the right. Okay. Now, we want to use this simple-minded graphical representation to represent more complicated objects, and I will take nonlinear functions on one vector. So now I have one vector x, and I want to have a nonlinear transformation from the space of vector x to the same space, or possibly to another space. So nonlinear transformation from one vector space to another one, and on the other hand, I will take infinite series in the sense of formal power series without, I could put a variable g power n in front of ln, but doesn't matter. So it's, I don't address the question of convergence, I take only formal power series, but I insist formal power series without selecting coordinates. That's the game. I don't select coordinate, but instead of that, I write formal power series. Now, ln, the nth term, in order to have the terms of degree n in your expansion, you take a multilinear function of n variable, and you substitute n times the same variable x to the n places, obviously. Of course, you can always assume that ls is symmetrical multilinear function. But it would be, of course, if you want to have something canonical, you have to insist that it is symmetric. But when you do calculation, it's not always convenient to stick only to multilinear symmetric function. Well, at the end, you symmetrize things if need. So, for instance, ln, according to my previous rules, is represented by a diagram. So you see clearly there are n legs and one top arrows, and ln is in the middle. So planar trees represent composition of multilinear operation. I gave just one example above. The two trees above represent a composition of two bilinear operation making a trilinear operation. So now if I have two such expansion, f of x is the sum of ln x, 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 x n times, and similarly for g, if I want to compose, that means replacing in f of x, I replace x by a function g of y. Of course, it's very easy to calculate formally this expansion, and it's quite complicated if you don't use graphical method, and it amounts to calculate higher order derivative of a composite function, which is a mess, of course. Fadi-Bruno formula. But if you want to be safe, the best way is to use graphical method, and from this, and using the obvious rule, it's easy to describe explicitly the rule. I don't need to do that at the moment, I just suggest that it is possible. Okay, now, but the point is that if you want to have a group, suppose that I consider function f of x whose have non-constant, zero constant terms, so they begin with n equal 1, and L1 is just x. So f of x is x, f of x is x plus L2 of xx plus L3 of xxx, etc. And it's clear that under composition, this form a group. And so that's the prototype of the group we want to describe. Okay, now let's come to second part, which is Lagrangians. So that's more in contact with physics. So Lagrangians, what can I do with Lagrangians? I hinted already, and the main point is that in a field, quantum field theory, usually I give a Lagrangian, which is an expression L of phi of x, which is a certain number depending on x, that means a function of x depending on another function of phi of x in a certain way. And now M, the domain, we consider that our function of field are function over a certain manifold D, which is a D-dimensional manifold. And generically, I denote by ddx some volume element in the D-dimensional manifold. Can be various things, but just to show that. Now, L of phi of x is a Lagrangian. So, typical example, which is so-called phi-4 model. L of phi of x consists of three terms. Well, m squared phi of x squared is easy to understand. Now, there is something which is, again, quadratic in phi, but quadratic in the first-order derivative. And that's so-called kinetical term. A term u nu is some quadratic form, usually in the in the Minkowski space, it's a quadratic form with signature plus, minus, 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 or minus, plus, plus, plus. I don't never know which one is a good one. So I have a certain quadratic form in the first order derivative, plus phi squared, m squared phi squared.
But it should be with a minus. It's in Minkowski space, it's always with a minus.
Okay. Let's forget I said about it.
This is your clean.
No, I said, the metric is either minus plus 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 or plus minus minus minus.
No, but even if you do that, you have to put minus
and plus. Okay. Let's correct it.
Yeah, because this changes sign on the
good. Okay. Okay. So, no, I don't intend to go into this subject for the moment. I know whether I reported that. Okay. D'accord. Now, the point, as I mentioned, for g equals zero, it's a quadratic form Q of phi, the first two terms. Well, physically, one considers that Q of phi is the unpaired term situation. So S of phi is just the integral over the whole space of a quadratic form in the first order derivative of phi. And then the perturbation G phi 4, phi x 4. Okay, let's consider first the case G equals 0. That means the quadratic form Q of phi, which consists of the two terms, possibly with a correction minus, of course. Then you have to consider two spaces. X is a space of function phi, which occurs there, which are called the fields. And in physics, we introduce a dual space, which is a space of sources, J. I'm not explicit about what kind of duality of function space. It may be S and S prime, they may be L2 and L2, it doesn't matter. The basic idea is that you have two functions here, Sobolev spaces. You have two functional spaces in the natural duality. But it's important to keep that. And usually if you claim it's only one Hilbert space, it's not correct. I mean, you have two different spaces. They may be isomorphic, but even if they are Hilbert spaces, it's good to distinguish the space from each one. So you have two spaces, X and X prime, and you have a duality which is represented at least formally, even if J and phi are distribution, by integral of J phi over the domain. So that's the starting point. Now, Q of phi, I have to explain that for the rest of what we have, it's not Q of phi itself which is relevant. It's a corresponding propagator or two-point function. And I explain that in a few lines. So what it is? So Q of phi is represented, phi is in X, is a space X, Q of phi is quadratic form, so it can be represented as D phi phi, D is an operator mapping X into X prime, D phi is a J, and then you take the duality J phi, so D phi phi, and if you use some symmetry, it's uniquely normalized. Now, D phi, in my example, D phi, well, don't care about the sign, don't question me about the sign, is minus a different partial differential operator of second order, which is a Lambertian in this case, plus constant term plus or minus M2 phi. So it's a linear operator. Now this operator, and if you fix correctly the boundary condition we describe precisely the space X, X, X prime, has a unique inverse, G, which maps X prime into X. And therefore, because the sources belong to X prime, if you apply G to a source, G of J of X, just an integral, it gives you a map from the sources to the field. And then, by playing the same game of making a dot product of the sources and the field, a scalar product of the field, you say, take J, G, J, explicitly written before, and you get a quadratic form on X prime. I'm just describing the fact that when you have a quadratic form on a space, you have another quadratic form on the dual.
Which is its inverse. It's really its inverse.
And I just explained that. And of course, in differential geometry, you have a GS square, which is this. And you have also, it's well known that we have the inverse G mu. Okay. So, usually, in Riemannian geometry, you have a quadratic form of a tangent bundle, and it gives an inverse quadratic form on the cotangent bundle. Okay. So just to fix the thing. And I call it W. Of course, W, if you, going from Q to W, just a very simple-minded example of Legendre transformation. And the point is that when you have Legendre transformation in classical mechanics, you can replace it formally by Fourier transformation in quantum physics. That means you insert here, you will insert here a factor of the type J phi, or JQ, well, phi, take it phi this time, J phi.
Over H bar.
Over H bar. And then you have the over H bar, and then you transform, if you S of phi, you add only in S of phi the quadratic form, then by this formal integral, you get an exponential, this is just a standard Gaussian integral. And it's important to notice that a standard formula of Gaussian integral, which are valid in finite dimensional spaces, extend very easily to infinite dimensional situation. I mean, we don't really know what is the Feynman path integral, but at least we know a certain set of rules which are certainly bona fide rules. In some sense, we are exactly in the same situation as people in the middle of the 18th century. They knew perfectly well calculus. They did not have the foundation, but they knew the root, which means that they did not know which function can be differentiated, which function can be integrated, but provided all the functions you consider can be obviously differentiated or integrated, the formula are true. So, I think it's quite parallel to that. Okay. Now, that just explained. But this important for what comes after is not the operator D or the quadratic form Q itself, it's the G, which is called in physics the two-point function or the covariance or whatever, or the propagator, there are many names. So, but what will be important later on is this G. But it's important to understand that it's all important that here we have something, two different things. Here, in this general formula of the action, you have d phi phi, which represents the quadratic terms in phi, and d, the inverse of d, is a covariance. But that's what we have to consider later on. Not d itself, its inverse. And now, but then when we come to the other terms, you can have more generally L of x1, x4, phi x1, etc., phi x4. What we had before is a very degenerate case when you integrate a product of phi four times itself at a given point over the space. So it's a very degenerate form of L. I will have to write it somewhere. So a more general form, in the more general form, you have two things, the covariance and the function L, or distribution L. And that's what we want to understand. Now, the new thing which comes in is regularization in quantum field theory. Regularization. What did I write? Oh, I wrote it perfectly for Cambridge at this time. Okay. So, in quantum field theory. So, as I said, in the 5-4 model described above, GXY is singular. It's the inverse of a differential operator. It's singular when X minus Y is on the light cone. If I was in the Euclidean domain, the singularity would occur when X is the same time as Y. But in the Minkowski space, you have a more extended singularity along the light cone, which is, by after all, the Huygens principle, nothing more. But on the other hand, what I wrote before corresponds to a certain factor L. L of X1 to X4 is G, a certain constant, multiplied by a product of beta factor. And this is singular when all X1, X4 coincide. So it's a distribution in four vectors, or that this is a product F of, over the product M times M times M times M, four factor, but it has a singularity when all the points on the diagonal, main diagonal. So that's, now that's the source of the difficulty. Of course, in quantum field theory, the main difficulty is that we have these two singularities. G of XY is singular on the light cone, or in the Euclidean case in, on the origin, or an L also is singular. Now, what the principle of regularization, there are many, many possible ways of regularization, but they all amount to replace GXY by something different. There are many ways, and they correspond to the various prescriptions of regularization amounts to replace mostly G by something more less singular, and occasionally L also by something less singular. One example of regularization, which is the introduction of the Schwinger parameters, is the following. Formally, G is the inverse of the differential operator. Now, the inverse of the differential operator formally is represented by integral of 0 to infinity exponential of minus alpha d d alpha. And it's now exponential of minus alpha d just amount to solve the heat equation. Of course, it's a kernel for the heat equation. And therefore, what you have, exponential of minus alpha d is a very smooth kernel for alpha positive, and it's a very smooth kernel, but you integrate from 0 to infinity. And contrary to most expectation, it's safe to integrate around alpha epsilon is infinity, because it's damping very fast the exponential, the sign of the exponential, but it's usually unsafe to integrate in the neighborhood of epsilon equals alpha equals 0. So, one way...
This is if you are in Euclidean, if you are in Minkowski.
Yeah, okay. Yes, I know.
So you are in Euclidean.
Let's see. I am in Euclidean. As I said, I mean, I'm just exploring the formalities of the system, not... the analysis is... what? It's under the understanding of analysis is good, so I don't have to insist on that. I insist on the combinatorics. Okay, so I agree. Replace your manifold by your Riemannian manifold and the eta mu nu by your quadratic positive definite form. Okay, but the point is that it's exactly a Schwinger parameter. And the important fact is that when you use this representation, well, here I consider it as a way to make a cutoff. If I integrate from epsilon to infinity, I'm just replacing d minus 1 by d minus 1 by this exponential. By an exponential of a d like that, it's a heat kernel, it's smoothing, it's very smoothing. And when you apply d minus 1 to it, or d to it, it's safe. So this operator for epsilon greater than 0 is certainly a very smooth operator. It has a kernel which is a smooth function everywhere. But we have to remove epsilon going to 0. But the fact is that when you go to further in this discussion, so far we had to integrate over the space M. That means over the vector, the variable X. And now when you will combine operators and multiply operator and calculate the kernel of a product operator by a rule which is similar, integration rule similar to the product of matrices, you will have to repeatedly integrate over the space M. That means the vector X. But if I do that, and that's a standard procedure, you can replace this integration by integration over certain parameters alpha. And it has many advantages. Many advantages. Even from the computational point of view, it has many advantages, but for me, it's important because it gives me a way of regularization, an example of a regularization procedure. Okay, just to make things a little more explicit, let's assume that we are in the Euclidean region, and so in the Euclidean space, and go to use Fourier transform, which is a convenient way, and so the D is the second order differential operator. So by Fourier transform, it amounts to multiply by a quadratic function plus a constant. The inverse is just multiplying by 1 over p squared plus m squared, and I'm just written 1 over p squared plus m squared as a certain integral over the same parameter alpha, just the same thing as before. And when I regularize, I integrate from alpha from epsilon to infinity. Okay, now, what we have is that radiative correct. So far, I did not modify L. But radiative correction, which I have no time to explain, it would require a whole course, but radiative correction is just the way that a particle, let's say, an electron can emit a photon and reabsorb it almost immediately after that. Radiative correction amounts to modification of both L0, which was the previous one, to an L epsilon. I don't say which way. It's a complicated way because it's not just a simple regularization. It takes into account radiative correction. It means already taking into account various Feynman diagrams. But just to compress, it's radiative correction amounts to changing L0 into L epsilon with some parameter epsilon, and regularization plus as before of D minus 1 plus radiative correction, amount and mass correction, radiative correction to the mass, amounts to modification of G0xy, which was this operator. So G0xy is formally minus Laplace, Dalamation plus, or minus M squared, minus 1 delta, to a certain G epsilon. Well, of course, it would require many hours to explain how do you produce that. But the point is that, starting from a well-known, from a very explicit regularization process, which uses a Schwinger parameter in the way I did, and putting into account the radiative correction, which is physics, then you end up by a candidate, instead of having G0 and L0, which bring you to the faculty, you have a regularization to a certain G epsilon and L epsilon. Okay. That's a very quick summary of a very complicated process. Now, what is the purpose of the, what is the purpose of renormalization this time? So now we have a flow. Well, the idea is that you have two kernels, G, XY, and L, X1, X2, X4. They are two singular. We smooth them, and we get something which is called G epsilon and L epsilon. This regularization is made in such a way that when epsilon goes to zero, G epsilon goes to G, and L epsilon goes to L. But when you have complicated expression made out of G epsilon and L epsilon, they will diverge. They will diverge. And the purpose, so the first part was regularization. Now the second part is renormalization. And renormalization amounts to the following. Renormalization amounts to the following. So, we have to discover a one parameter family, R of 1 over epsilon, of nonlinear transformation of pairs of kernels. I write R of 1 over epsilon because in most cases it's a polynomial, at each order it's a polynomial in 1 over epsilon. It's a thing which is dangerous when epsilon goes to 0. So, G epsilon, L epsilon. When epsilon goes to 0, they go to something too. But when complicated expressions depending on them are singular when epsilon goes to 0. And what you want? You want to correct this this blowing up by a nonlinear transformation of the pair GL. But now I view, as I said, my Lagrangian was described by a quadratic part, which is given either by the quadratic form QO by the corresponding inverse, which is G, and an interaction term, which is L. So I have a certain class of Lagrangian. It depends on two kernels, G and L. And I want to describe a certain group of nonlinear transformation in this space of Lagrangian, that means in this space of pairs of kernels, G of two variable and of four variable, such that by applying R1 of epsilon, and R1 of epsilon will be a certain family in a certain group, that we have to discover. By applying this to G epsilon and epsilon, so that every expression will have a finite limit where epsilon goes to zero, and that's exactly the way we want to renormalize things. So, I have to admit that this is very sketchy, but I come to my main point now. So, just to explain what I'm doing. Now, my main point here, I will start with a certain toy model. So, the toy model is as follows. I'm considering a certain finite dimensional vector space, which I call V. Its dual is called V prime. And since everything is finite dimensional, V is a dual of V prime, and V prime is a dual of V. Now, I take a space L for Lagrangian, which is a product of sim 4 V prime and sim 2 V. That means, I use the standard notation, vectors in V are represented with upper indices, and vectors in V prime dual by vectors with lower indices, subscript and superscript, and then the tensor, so L is a space whose elements are a pair of symmetric tensors, a symmetric tensor of order 4 with all indices below, because vectors in V prime have lower indices, and then a symmetric tensor has 4 or lower indices, And G is as upper indices in the symmetric part of the second tensor product of V with itself. So, okay. Now we are considering this as a tall model. Before we had functional operator, instead of V being a finite dimension operator, everything were operators over some Banach space or Hilbert space. Now we take this tall model. But we will see the important thing is that in this tall model we will lose nothing of the combinatorics. That's the basic idea. The combinatorics, once you understand them, will be transported word for word in the general situation. Okay. Now, so I write tensor with indices, but you will see in a moment that it's not important to write indices, or rather it is safe to write indices. Okay, so now you are looking for nonlinear transformation of this space of pairs of tensors, which is invariant with respect to the linear automorphism of V. That means they can be obtained via the standard rule of the tensor calculus. If there are two tensors, you can take the tensor product, you can permute the indices, and you can make contraction between a lower index and a upper index. For instance, just take one example. I take a pair LG, and I will transform it into another pair, lambda gamma. Writing indices, I write lambda, alpha, beta, gamma, delta. Well, important point is there are two factors and one factor G. Again, gamma is obtained by one factor L and three factor G. Well, you just count the number of indices and you match the indices, and that's easy to discover. So you have this transformation. And you want to have similar transformation of a higher type, higher degree, so it will be an infinite finite or infinite series of such term with possible constant in front, linear combination, but each term will be produced in this way. So lambda and gamma as obtained by L and G. You have a certain number of factors L and a certain number of factors G. Okay. Now we want to, it's quite difficult to understand, well, these indices, but you will see that how to make a graphical representation. And that's exactly what we need, graphical representation. So, repeat the same formula as before, and write now this in graphical form. Now, on the left side, you have, well, maybe I show you on the other slide. Keep your slide. So, you see that lambda had four indices, so lambda has four legs, and now you see that in the formula there were two factors L and two factors G, so you see two blobs representing L, because it's L, it has four indices, so you need four legs out of L, each factor L, and now G, you see that the two factor G, but G, you see that the purpose is to contract indices. And so I represent just G by a fat dot, and I've written all the indices. So, you have alpha, beta, gamma, delta, so which are the outside, indices, they remain outside the summation, but of course, I did not apologize, but this is implied summation, of course. But implied summation graphically represents to glue together two legs. And the two legs are glued by G. They are glued by G. And so you have two factors L and two factors G. And so I put explicitly the factor L, which are certain vertices of order 4, and the small dot G. Well, it's because there is a recurrent controversy among physicists whether we should put the propagator explicitly in the graph. I agree with you that we should. Okay, so, but then we have this. And similarly for gamma out of G and L, well, you're right. But now what you see is that, of course, when you could put orientation, and we'll do that in a moment, you see that the purpose of the indices, mu, rho, and pi, first of all, the indices over which you make summation are totally implicit and just describe a certain combinatorial way of gluing legs with each other. So, of course, Whether you pretend that you have coordinates and that components with respect to some coordinates doesn't matter. For the combinatory, it just means certain bracketing. Okay. And now, of course, the exterior indices alpha, beta, gamma, delta are just to record which on the left, which alpha correspond to which leg on the left correspond to which leg on the right. So it's purely descriptive. Now we do the same for gamma. Now I want to describe the class of corresponding graphs. The corresponding graphs, and I follow more or less a description given by Manin for that, which is, well, I think, one of the most convenient. We start with a family of corollas. A corolla is a certain vertex, and my corollas are of order 4. So each factor L corresponds to a certain corolla, and each corolla has 4 half edges. I insist that what comes, so external edge. For the physicists, I'm working with amputated graphs. So external legs really are half edges. And Manin calls them flag because it corresponds to orientation. Okay, so it doesn't matter. Flag is by Manin, I use usually half edges. So we have a family of corollas. So if you have 2 factors L at the top, you put 2 corollas side by side. Then, so you have the first graph which is totally disconnected. So a corolla for the 4, another corolla, etc. Then you decide to do the sewing, or the grafting, if you want. Sewing, grafting, it's the same. And inserting a factor G amounts to sew together 2 half edges to make a hedge. So for me, a hedge like in at the top is a collection of 2 half edges. And it's important when I want to calculate the number of automorphism of my graph. By definition, an automorphism of the graph is a permutation of the collection of half edges, which is compatible with the structure. So for instance, suppose I have this. What is the number of automorphism? According, there is one edge, but one loop. Well, of course, but that one loop has 2 halves. And you have to count, a symmetry of the graph is a permutation of the half edges. So there. So the number of automorphisms is 2. It's always a small difficulty. But I think by introducing these half edges, you have a clear definition. And no doubt about what you count. And by the way, it's usually, by eyesight, it's quite difficult on a given graph to describe, to find the number of automorphisms. And you will find in the master thesis of my student a very convenient and mechanical way to, by generating series, which came from some German paper that Dirk mentioned to me, generate properly the list of graphs of a certain kind is always a nuisance, but there exists a procedure by generating series which produces at each level not only the collection of graphs but also the number of automorphisms of each graph, so completely automated. And, well, my student did it by hand, but of course it could be programmed very easily. So, and maybe it will, well, I have to discuss with Dirk feasibility. Okay, so that's this. My graphs are obtained. I mean, I start with a collection of corolla, flowers if you want, corolla flowers, and then I glue together pairs of half edges to produce edges. But I don't mean, upstairs. You have 2 factors, so there are 2 corollas, 8 edges. Now you decide to glue 2 pairs, which means that instead of having 8 half edges, you have now 2 edges plus 4 half edges which remain, which are the external legs. So in this procedure, the distinction between external leg and internal edges is very clear. Okay. And that gives, and you can give a formal definition of what it is, what is the gluing, what it's easy to describe. Okay. So, and there are various ways of encoding that by permutation and so on. We explore various ways to represent these things. And with the purpose of automating the calculation. Okay. So that's a kind of graph, looking at the example is better than listening to complicated explanation. So now, I come to the point about orientation. For me, it's not that important, but it's good to be explicit. So, question of orientation. My corollas are oriented toward the outside. And by convention, if an arrow goes to the outside, it means a lower index. And if it goes inside, it's an upper index. So it's very convenient. Well, I did not invent this. So for instance, if I want to consider vectors in the space V, which I call feet, they correspond to dot with one arrow flowing in. In the same way, sources corresponding to element in the dual correspond to one dot with an arrow which pointing to the outside. And so for instance, if you glue together, if you consider the scalar product between a vector phi in V and a J vector J in V prime, this is just this. You have two dots, J and phi, and one arrow, which clearly indicates whether you are in the space or in the dual. Again, the quadratic form W of J, which was inverse to the Q, represented this way. So, and as you've seen, it's explained the convention that for the dot, which represents the propagator, G, I mean the two arrows come in, and that explains because this is compatible with this convention. So this just, but as we see in the class of diagram I'm considering, I don't need to be explicit about the orientation, they are completely automatic. If I draw the diagram without orientation, the orientation are completely automatic. So I don't have to worry too much about that. But in some situation, well, because I have a scalar field, and if I had a fermion field, okay, no, because here I have a scalar field, that means a bosonic field, so I don't have to consider the orientation, well, they come out of nothing. But if I had fermion, it would be much more complicated. And so I just mentioned that because, of course, I have to admit that so far, well, I never thought carefully about the fermionic case, and we ought to do that. But, okay. Okay. So, now, I come to the group itself, and now, what is the group I'm considering? It's a group of transformations, which transform a pair of tensors. L is, according to the standard definition, it's L is a covariant symmetric tensor of order 4, and G is a contravariant symmetric tensor of order 2. So I'm considering pairs, L and G, and I'm considering nonlinear transformation of L and gamma. Now, such a transformation is represented by two series of graphs. I mean, when you want to calculate gamma out of L and G, it's a combination, linear combination of terms, possibly infinite, with infinitely many terms. And because you want that the final result will be tensor of the same kind as G, that means two external legs, you have to consider a series of graphs, each graph in the series having two external legs. We have seen example before of that. Similarly, the transformation of L into lambda is dictated by a series of graphs with four external legs. So we give two series of graphs. In the first series, every graph has two external legs. In the other series, every graph has four external legs. Moreover, we want to have transformation of the type which is here. F of x is x plus higher order term, which means that there will be among the series with two external legs, you will have simply this graph, which corresponds to G going into G, and similarly for L going into L. So that's just because we want to have a group, and it's well known that if we want to have a group for composition, it's good to start with transformation with X. Of course, we could have a linear transformation, but it brings you nothing for the moment. Except scaling in some cases, but of course. Okay, it brings to nothing for now. So we consider. So we have we consider all the nonlinear transformation of the pair of tensors, which are invariant under the action, natural action of the linear group of V, GLV, acting on V and its dual. And by the standard rule of tensor calculus, each one can be represented by two such series of graphs. Now, of course, the composition is obvious at the algebraic level, and it dictates exactly what you should write at the combinatorial level. So I don't have to invent rules. It just come out of that, because I want to represent the composition. Okay, these rules are quite complicated, I have to admit. And, well, first of all, if you have just the transformation of this type, I mean, f, so f of x in one variable, f of x is x plus a2 of x2 plus a3 of x3 plus etc. And you have similarly g of x is x plus b2 x squared plus etc. I mean, calculating the power series of f of gx, that means calculating the higher order derivative of a composition, it's a mess. It's a Fadi-Bruno formula, well-known Fadi-Bruno formula, and it's quite complicated. But here, so you can expect that it is rather complicated. I don't want, well, certainly, but I insist that you don't have to be clever. You just have to be patient. And that's my advice. Don't be clever, be patient. So, now you have a group, and you know that, and you have a group, and that it is a group is, requires no verification. No verification at all. I insist on that point. Associativity is granted. Inverse is granted. Associativity is granted because composition is associative. Inverse is granted because when you want to invert, well, to want to inverse a series of the type f of x, so if you want to inverse an equation of the type y is x plus etc., by finding the power series expansion of x in terms of y, it's also automatic. So you don't have. So I insist that the group, that you have a group is, comes out just of the definition. Now, if you want to check that once you have transformed your definition of your group by composition into a purely combinatorial rule, and if you want to check everything, associativity, inverse, and so on, at the combinatorial level, it's a mess. I agree. But I try to bypass this complicated step by this procedure. Okay. Yes. So, I think I'm at the end of my notes, so I thought to use a blackboard now, and so. So, now what did I say about the group, Hopf algebra and the Lie algebra? Well, I will use something which is more easy, and which has been already considered by many people, including Alain and his co-workers. Okay, let's take this example. I consider the group of transformation of this type, and now the composition, I use a composition. F of G is F of G of X. Okay, now, if I just, well, by definition, this is X plus sum N at least 2 of AN GX to the N. Now, GX being what it is here, I can calculate gx to the n. Gx to the n as a power series. In principle, it's easy. But what you see is that gx to the n, if you look at the various coefficients, there will be polynomials in the b's, whose total degree is at most n. Well, if you want to have total degree n, you put b1. Okay. At most n, provided you consider that b2 has degree 2, b3 has degree 3, etc. So, when you calculate explicitly the series hx, which h is a composition of hfg, so h of x is sum fx plus sum n over at least 2 cnxn, you end up with a complicated set of expression, which is that each cn is a certain polynomial in a1 an, b1 bn, quite a complicated polynomial. With one feature, interesting feature, that it is linear in the eighth. Because, of course, when you compose f of g with g, it's linear in f. And that's exactly why we meet with this class, special class called the pre-algebra of Weinberg identity or symmetric or whatever. So it's a special class. We get a special class of group, not the most general Lie group. But what we have an expression of this type. So it's Cn is expressed explicitly by a certain polynomial in a1an, b1bn. Now, Hopf algebra means the following. That you introduce Hopf algebra means the following. You introduce a ring O, which is, let's take the complex number as coefficient, polynomial ring into variable x2, x3, x4, etc. And the degree of xn is n. Now, if we consider polynomials in A and B, so I write it Ox in A and B, are elements in OA tensor OB. By OA, I mean the polynomial when I label the variables as A and the same for OB. Polynomials in A and B are simply this tensor product. Now, the rules which were given here, Cn is a certain polynomial in An and AB, means that you have homomorphies from OC into OA tensor OB. But of course, writing C, A, and B are just labels. And I'm just too fancy to say OC, OAOB. It's really the same ring, O. So I have a map or homomorphy from O into O tensor O, which is exactly the invariant way to express this set of formulas. Cn is a polynomial in A and B. Okay, so this is called a coproduct. But of course, once you have this coproduct, you have explicitly the rule of multiplication, and conversely, the rule of multiplication is completely equivalent to a certain map from O to O, O tensor. And associativity inverse and so on can be expressed by various properties which are summarized by saying you have a Hopf algebra which is commutative as an algebra, but not as a coalgebra. Okay. So that's the way how to go from a group to Hopf algebra. Now, if you start with my definition of the group and you play the game, you will end up exactly with the Hopf algebra on Kronenkrein. Exactly. So it's another description. But just, well, the slight advantage of that, I have no verification to do. I mean, everything comes out automatically because I started from the group and I derived the Hopf algebra. Usually one does the opposite. Now, of course, once you have the Hopf algebra, you can derive from it a Lie algebra, which is as follows. First of all, it's better to do a Lie coalgebra. Okay, let's introduce in O M. M is a set of polynomial without constant term. So the polynomial will give zero when you specialize all the variables to zero.
Cartier, what is not clear to me is where is the one particle irreducible?
Well, I cannot answer at the moment. We have to discuss it.
Yeah, because I mean, it's quite important.
Yeah.
You restrict one particle.
Maybe it's something bigger.
So I think it's bigger. This one is bigger.
I suppose. If I make no restriction, it's bigger. Yeah. Okay. So I would say, Hopf algebra on Kronenkrein is a sub Hopf algebra.
Yeah, because I mean, what you are describing is more like the diffeomorphisms of the Lagrangians.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, but it's not the same thing.
Exactly.
You have to be careful. Okay. I mean, you know, there is a map from one to the other, but one has to be careful.
Okay. So, but just we have to discuss that. Lie algebra, out of Hopf algebra, you get the following. You have two ideals. First of all, O is a set of four polynomials. M, polynomial without constant term. M square, polynomial without terms of degree 0 and 1. And M over M square, N over M square, is just, I mean, the set of linear polynomials, if you want. And now, out of this product, by proper integration, call this, this lambda. Out of this, you get a lambda, oh no, lambda is not proper. T. T. What you get is a map from, by anti-symmetrization of T into lambda 2T. And call it small delta. And a Lie coalgebra is a space T with a linear map from T into lambda 2T, satisfying certain axiom. And by duality, you get lambda T star into lambda, into T star, and this is a bracket in the dual. So the Lie algebra is obtained by taking the dual of M over M squared. Okay, now, in terms of graphs, this Lie algebra can be easily interpreted, and that was done already by Kronenkreimer, and it's as follows. We have, so suppose we have a certain graph which has four external legs. And suppose, so this is graph gamma. And suppose that you have another gamma prime which also has four external legs. And you want to calculate. So this graph label a certain basis, a certain graph label a basis of the Lie algebra. And you want to calculate the bracket. Now the bracket is obtained as follows. First of all, you select one vertex V, inner vertex in gamma. It's of order 4. Now, what you do, you zoom over, you remove that vertex and you zoom. You zoom, so therefore what you have is that instead of a vertex, so you zoom, you have a certain region, and out of that vertex there were four legs. So you have a region to zoom. Then you insert this into this, taking into account proper identification. Here you have four legs, here you have four legs, and you take the mean value over all permutations. 1 over factorial 4 of all permutations. Okay. And then you do repeat that over all vertices, inner vertices. You take a summation. But that's not enough. It's not entirely symmetric this way. So you repeat the same calculation by interchanging gamma and gamma pi, and you subtract. And this is the rule which was discovered by Alain and Dirk for the Lie algebra. Now, with Marcus Berger, I had certain normalization for the Hopf algebra, and Dirk and Alain had a certain normalization for the Lie algebra, and there were difficulties, but now it's settled. Now we have followed, my student, that was the purpose of his master thesis to settle this question. It's straightened now. So, just for finish, one word for finish, I would say that I took this toy model, let's try to find it again. I found this term, but I insisted that I was acting on pairs of two tensors, L, which is a symmetric tensor of order 4 into V prime, and G, which was a symmetric tensor of order 4 into V. But what is happening if, instead of having a finite vector space, we take a one-dimensional vector space? That means we take V equal V prime equal C. Now your tensor become numbers, L and G. And just by taking this special case, you produce a formal power series, two formal power series in L and G. No, exactly, because what I said is completely functorial with respect to V. I can't specialize to the case. Of course, in a physics situation, I was interested in a Banach space or Hilbert space or certain infinite dimensional space. Now, all the my point is that all the combinatorics is contained when you do that with symmetric vector spaces of finite dimension. It's just a consequence of the standard result about invariance, I mean, the fundamental theorem of invariance. It's nothing more, nothing more. So, all the combinatorics is faithfully represented in the finite dimensional case. Now, in the finite dimensional case, I can go to the extreme and say, take the one-dimensional case. And I replace everything by formal power series, which is a homomorphism from the group to the group of nonlinear transformation of the two, and its respect composition.
But what is not so clear is that, you know, in the paper with Dirk, what we had a very complicated formula because we had to take the renormalized coupling, and the renormalized coupling uses the field strength renormalization, which is not present here, and which was taken to the minus one-third power. So, yes. You know, there is something very, very subtle there. I mean, okay. If you don't take that into account, you know, then it really is...
No, but...
Because it is this
rule
of our calculus.
No.
But if you have to take this field strength
normalization... Okay, I know how to get out of that.
You need something more than LNG.
I need to take scaling. I know how to take scaling into account in this framework. Right. To simplify, I said that there are nothing, but I could take the scaling into account. And if I put the scaling, everything comes out. And the one, and why you need the one third, etc. The power. No, I admit that I never wrote this part in detail. This is not in the thesis of my student. And that's what I have to write now. I agree. That's okay. Okay. Thank you very much.